Committee for Monday, July 18, 2005, for the purpose of a work session on Senate Bill 232 relating to juveniles, and also Senate Bill 817 relating to emergency management. And we will start with Senate Bill 817 relating to emergency management. Senator Metzger, would you like to come forward with whomever you'd like to join you?
Well, I'll take Washington with me. We'll start this way.
Great. And, okay. Mr. Wilson, do you have any opening comments that you'd like to make for the record?
No, Madam Chair, except there are a few handouts in front of you. One is our memo, which has one amendment attached to it. There is a second amendment that we just received a few minutes before the meeting, and then there's a handout from Chief Jeffrey Johnson, who is chair of the Oregon State Interoperability Council, and I believe now I have a copy of public testimony from one of the gentlemen in front of you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And it's our expectation, Senator Winters will join us. She's very timely. Thank you, Senator Winters. Please go forward.
Okay, I'll make this brief. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Winters, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. We have a lot of expertise in this room, so they'll be able to walk me through the specificity of Senate Bill 817. But I would suffice it to say that SB 817 is one of the critical pieces of legislation this session, because it deals with the security of our state. In a lot of ways, certainly we're more in tune with the issues of homeland security as it does pertain to the state of Oregon, but also the other natural disasters, which we have talked about in many different ways and in different bills, legislation throughout the last number of years in the legislature. But what has come very apparent to those who are entrusted with maintaining our safety is the extremely poor condition of our communications. And the interoperability of communications between major agencies do not coordinate well. Not only do they not coordinate well because of the technology, but also in many cases, those systems that currently exist are antiquated. What is really, really tied going forward is the requirement from the federal government by the year 2013 that we have to have a system on which all the important emergency agencies can communicate together. So we are mandated to do that. The question is, having the planning put into place, what Senate Bill 817 does is initiate that most critical step, which is beginning the planning process for this. And bear with me, Mr. Murphy is the director of the Oregon Emergency Management Department. We'll go through the specifics. But it is absolutely critical that that planning be begun. It's not very far away before this has to be completed. We have all the agencies who are ready, willing to step forward and start making sure that our communications are up to par for all the eventualities that could befall our state, and so that the people that we have entrusted to take care of us will be able to communicate and communicate effectively. With that, Madam Chair, I appreciate your consideration, Senator Lee, once again.
Very good. And are you going to stay with us, Senator?
I will for a moment, yes.
Okay, very good. We do understand the importance of the bill and also the urgency around the public policy issue. We both recall, I know Senator Winters recalls the testimony from the Oregon State Police about the deficiencies in the current communication system, and so this is very, very timely that we're dealing with the subject matter now, and most certainly before we sign it by. Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Chair Gordley. Senator Winters, I appreciate the opportunity to get up and talk about this. And I want to, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management and also a Deputy Director for Oregon's Office of Homeland Security. And I want to also thank Senator Metzger and his staff for all their support in this very important issue. Just a couple clarifications. So there's, we had talked about this before, and Chief Johnson had testified, and one of the issues, Senator Gordley, that you had brought up was the inclusion of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And we've, in the amendments, the dash three, and then I think the current four that's in front of you, also puts the State Interoperability Executive Council, which is right now acting under a governor's executive order, and this just puts it into legislation and adds the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training into that.
Excellent. Thank you.
I think the premise, as Senator Metzger talked about, and I know both yourself, Senator Gordon, and Senator Winters have been back to ground zero, and you've heard many, many stories about communications, and of course we all remember the stories of the police and firefighter on opposite side of the walls that couldn't talk. And public safety, no matter if you're a state, county, or city, is a crucial thing for a five-gallon oil spill all the way up to the worst disaster that we can possibly have. And as Senator Metzger talked about, this bill takes that first step in addressing the communications infrastructure of the state of Oregon, and specifically of the Departments of State Police, Transportation, Corrections, and Forestry. The handout that I provided you on the first page is some written testimony. On the second page is kind of an odd little display of the state of Oregon with a whole lot of dots on it. And what you see there is a composite of Department of Forestry, Department of Transportation, and Department of State Police with all of their communication sites. So it kind of gives you an idea where they're at, and it also kind of gives you an idea that they're not necessarily all in the same place, which is part of the issues that we want to try and address as we move forward. The other thing that's critical to our issues of this bill, not only is improving public safety communications in the state, but the Federal Communications Commission's mandate to go to narrowband technology by January 1st, 2013. Now, even though that is roughly, give or take a day, 8 years away, in times of doing a project of this size and scope, it's very limited amount of time. And a lot of people that are not familiar with communications wonder what narrowband technology means. Well, it's actually something that will be very helpful to the public safety arena, but it's kind of hard to visualize. If you would visualize today in our communication systems that a communication system is a highway like we have out here in front of the Capitol, and we have cars going down each lane. Well, the Federal Communications Commission has cut that lane in half and told everybody to drive motorcycles. And you can get more motorcycles on that one small lane, and that's what narrowband technology is. They're closing up the bands, but yet more people can go on those bands because of new technology, which we don't necessarily have across the state. This plan that 817 will address in my testimony here in these four agencies, the condition of our agencies right now vary from good to poor. I'm not going to go into any detail. I think you've heard of some of the stories. Some of them are very good. Others are literally falling apart, and we do buy parts off of eBay to fix some of those systems because it's old technology, not readily available to buy off the shelf. And when we talk about these locations, primarily these mountaintops and the things that sit on those mountaintops, we are looking at the physical location, we're looking at backup power systems to those locations, the actual conditions of the radio equipment and the towers that support the antennas or the microwave dishes. We're looking at the security of the site and the conditions of the buildings inside and out. Because as we move forward, not only do we want to improve the ability to communicate, but we want to improve the ability to have a site that will last us many, many years into the future from a security standpoint, and also things near and dear to my heart like earthquakes and things like that, that they can sustain any type of disaster so that we can try and ensure to the best of our abilities that the state has communications. Current policies, as I stated, as we move forward towards 2013, this legislation, we want to try and take these four state agencies, and I might note, you see the Department of Corrections is not listed on there. They do use the system that's part of the other three agencies, you know, to communicate as they move prisoners around and for other issues. And I might also add there's many other agencies that use pieces and parts of the system to support their needs. But anyway, this is really about centralizing Oregon's radio and microwave infrastructure among these state agencies so that we can move forward into a better more modern system that will last us at least 20 to 40 years into the future. We also want to take a look at this as we move forward in a way to increase our ability to provide interoperability to all agencies, whether it be city, county, or state. Many of these tower sites do support county and city and special districts across the state, so we want to support that to improve their ability to communicate. This money that's involved, we've submitted a fiscal impact statement. Right now we have money from the Department of Homeland Security under the fiscal year 05 grants. And we right now have approximately a little over $340,000-some, and that will be to initiate a request for proposal that will be able to go out and help us start identifying our system, what the real problems are, and then to look at recommendations on how we can improve that system, not necessarily buying a whole new system, but what ways are out there that we can create a system of systems through new technology. I seriously don't know and doubt that there will ever be enough money to replace everything 100%, so we're going to have to be smart in how we attempt this and use different technologies that are out there that can help current systems instead of buying brand new ones. And then the ultimate goal, too, is to enforce and secure a better system for the state of Oregon that not only supports all the agencies but supports various redundant links. So if part of the state goes down, then we have redundancies that will go back around some other portion of the system to help it survive. And finally, that will create further architectural designs and recommendations as technology changes as we move into the future of the next 20 to 40 years, so that in 20 to 40 years we're not sitting here again talking about doing the same thing, that we can constantly have a livable, doable plan to try and create a system that will support us well into the future. Our desired goals with this legislation, which I think is important to the success of public safety in Oregon, that it suits all levels of Oregon government. It does not matter which level. It allows ownership and operation of the systems in the same way it's presently done today. We're not here to try and usurp anything from any agency. We want to provide the same amount of services, whether it be voice, data, or video that they may need. We also want to does not mandate or force a solution on anyone. We have a group that's been meeting for at least a year right now trying to make sure that we are all understanding of the process, understanding of the ultimate goals, understanding of each other's needs, and that we'll all try to work together in a collaborative fashion to achieve this goal of interoperability. And as I mentioned earlier, it simply allows for continued future growth and expansion. So, considering I'm not a technical expert, if you want to know megahertz and VHF and UHF, I'll answer any questions other than that.
Senator Winters?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My only question that I would have is, Senator Gordon and I were back in New York after 9/11, and communication was a major gap when you looked at what was occurring back in New York and also in Washington and across the country. As you look at from 9/11 till today, what new technology or what have we learned as a result of 9/11? Because I know that particular conference that we were at, there was a lot of discussion of having to address this particular issue, and I'm just wondering if there have been, based on history, based on the concern, whether or not through that process there have been some positive pieces that have come out of not only the conference but come out of Washington and other states.
Correct. Chair Gordley, Senator Winters, there definitely has. as you can well imagine, we've created a cottage industry because people finally admitted to the fact that we've had communications problems. I think in the past, everybody, in all honesty, has tried very hard to make those things work together, but have never, it's kind of like writing a plan and putting on the bookshelf and never testing it until you have the event. And I think that's where they really realized that maybe we've not been truly honest with ourselves. We've also learned that, as I mentioned earlier, there isn't enough money to replace all the systems. It's just a very expensive adventure. We also learned that everybody across the spectrum, no matter what level of government they are, they've invested for the last 10, 15, 20 years in improving their systems, and they don't necessarily want to just give them up and buy something brand new. So a lot of technology has emerged in really computer-driven technology that provides gateways. And it's a computer programs and computer technology that will take two disparate systems and hook them together so that you won't have to buy an entirely brand new system. So, and there's also some other technology out there that will do the same thing. It's more actual radio-based where it will hook systems together. And I think also what we learned from September 11th is there's a lot more people that should be hooked to these public safety systems other than what we would traditionally think of in the way of police and fire and emergency medical services. I know both of you, dear to your hearts, the mental health and behavioral health community, public health, there's just so many more agencies and groups out there that we need to be cognizant of that need the ability to be able to speak in these large groups when a disaster does happen. And I think that will, carefully managed, will help us provide better response and recovery to the citizens of the state of Oregon. And I think the technology is out there. I think what we need to do, and I hope this committee and this legislation that's working on this will take the time to very carefully analyze and make sure that we are making the right investments that will allow everybody in Oregon to talk, and that we clearly define those groups so that we don't have to fear not being able to talk in the moment of an emergency.
Director Murphy, can you talk about the public health side of this equation and where and when you see public health being at the table as a partner? Again, given everything that has been learned, given everything that we know about how important it is to have public safety ready to respond in the case of what may be a natural disaster, what may be some horrible other event, when do they come to the table?
Madam Chair, they've been to the table just recently, and I do sit on the Health Preparedness Advisory Council and the Hospital Preparedness Advisory Council, and I also sit on the Behavioral Health Group that's worked on the Behavioral Health Plan, and we've tried to work together very closely. They're just now emerging to address the communications issues. As you know, they've been very busy trying to deal with just the simple requirements that the Centers for Disease Control and the Health Resources Services Administration has placed upon them to address all the public health and hospital issues. And we have representatives from the health arena come to the State Interoperability Executive Councils. We also have a representative that sits on the Statewide Investment Infrastructure Group right now. And probably the first emerging issue that the public health and the hospital arena is dealing with right now is they are getting ready to spend money on communications in hospitals and the surrounding area to deal with the surge capacities of hospitals during any disaster, and obviously specifically terrorism. And then we've looked at, and frankly we have not come up to any 100% solutions in how communications would work at a public health office or a mental health office in a county or city. We're trying to take a look at their structure and how that would fit and who they need to talk to, and especially in using the case of the behavioral health where they have the teams, the crisis teams that can go out, what's the best avenue and type of equipment to provide them as we plan ahead into the future. They are at the table. I would tell you we don't have any absolute solutions, but they are at the table right now talking.
Excellent. I have another question for you related to the current Homeland Security funding, which you describe as funding that will, again, reading from your paper here, facilitate the initial efforts. What, again, is the timeline for those initial efforts? And let's start there. The timeline to achieve A through E?
Yeah, Chair Gordley, right now we do have the money in the bank. Okay. It was part of the 05 grants, and we are pretty much prepared. We still have some touch-up work to do on an RFP, request for proposal, to take a look at that A through E and make sure we're having some technical experts take a look at it. And so the money is there to go out and work on all those issues to help us identify, you know, what's wrong, what's broken, what we should do with some recommendations on a short-term and long-term basis.
I'm trying to get a better sense of 8 years isn't a lot of time.
No.
It really isn't. And so A through E in that eight-year
mm-hmm.
time span take up how much time on the front end?
Chair Gordley, we're estimating, and I can't give you a 100% answer, but we're estimating that it will take at least a year to work on that. And in the interim, as we continue to look at funding options for the future through Homeland Security, but we think it'll be a little over a year to be able to accomplish that, and we want to keep it to that because we are running out of time. And so hopefully within that 1 year's period, we'll be able to develop enough information and start taking steps to meet that mandate by 2013.
Okay. Madam Chair, just a
certainly
follow-up to that, because I'm pleased that you're doing the assessment to deal with the communication piece, because if there was anything that we heard following 9/11,
mm-hmm.
it was the, even though we all believed that we had the ability to use our cell phones and to use various technology, I think they found that when you have a major catastrophe, something like that, that the communication is gone. And one entity could not talk to another entity. And the only way that we actually have of getting through is through communication, whether it is the telephone or whether it is the computer. And that was a major piece. The other major piece, if I can recall the conversation back in New York, was the ability, the first responders, and who should be a part of the first response. And I think it was learned then that it was more than just our public safety and our fire department, and even though we had the Red Cross was there, it was learned that unless we have certain policies and certain things in place, and it was kind of interesting to me that the faith community was somehow left out of that equation of communication, and yet there is the tendency of us to go there first, and they weren't included, if you will, in the first response to the major catastrophe. And I'm just hoping that and then I do see that the private the nonprofit community is a part of the executive group, and I would just encourage, because when catastrophes occur, there is the human behavior of the human to go to that place that they feel safe. And it's kind of interesting. I think we learned that, mm-hmm. if nothing else, from 9/11, that the first place that people, individuals, went were to the churches, they are went to those safe havens, and so it's kind of when we say first responders, and I know mental health and public health, you know, very much aware they were with us. In fact, Oregon was the only state, if I recall, that included its legislators as well as the executive branch.
That's right.
We were, of all the 50 states that were there, recognizing that we needed the comprehensive public policy and that included the legislative branch as well as the executive branch. So I really just needed to put that on the record, because for some of us, I don't think we'll ever forget the image of 9/11.
Chair Gordley, Senator Winters, I couldn't agree more, and I think 9/11 did bring out those issues, especially with behavioral health and people's attitude and their cares and concerns, and I think that's been there a long time, but sometimes we have a way of not bringing those out, and I think it's good that that happened in the respect that that focus was brought there, because even people that were not directly right at ground zero had effects that needed to be treated. And too often during any disaster, you know, we treat people right at the site of the disaster, and we don't think about those people that might be 1 mile or 2 mile or 3,000 miles away. So, and I think the definition of first responder changes almost every day. I think it would be safe to say that anybody can be a first responder in today's world. And I think we need to make sure that we don't overlook anybody. And I guess I would close just simply with the final comment that no matter how much preparation we make for disasters, whether it's natural or terrorist, one of the first things that you need to start the process is communications. And so this Senate Bill 817, I think, is without that, I think we fool ourselves thinking that we're going to be able to do a really good job if we can't communicate. Because without that communications, like you said, cell phones, pagers, PDAs, computers, a lot of that could be non-functional. So we've got to take every opportunity to come up with many redundant, positive future solutions that will help us across the spectrum.
The one concern I have is about the funding level and whether it is enough to actually complete the list of tasks that you have in front of you. That amount of money seems unrealistic to me, given the breadth and scope of the work in front of you. So I'll just say that for the record, and we'll stay tuned to hear what you learn as you move forward, unless you want to make additional comments.
Chair Gordley, I would only say for the record, there probably is not enough money, but we hope that careful planning, good work with all of our partners, getting good technical experts to help us make the best solutions and the best fiscal solutions. Hopefully this initial pot of money will get us to that point that we identified the issues, identified what we can do to fix it, and that will take us to the next step of actually working on it. And we've actually done some work in fixing the systems now with other Homeland Security funds from past years, but we really need to take a look at the whole system, and I hope there's enough money.
All right. Mr. Wilson, we have in front of us the April 14th version of the bill, A engrossed, mm-hmm. which is inclusive of the -3 amendments or not?
It is inclusive, or it is as in front of you. I'm not sure what the -3 amendments are. You have -4 amendments that have been brought forward, and a -5 amendments, which are our amendments. The -5s are attached to my memo, and the -4 should have been handed out in the grouping with you.
Chair Gordley, I think that the -3s really added in the State Interoperability Executive Council.
All right.
The -4 corrected and added in the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Excellent. Okay.
And the -5 puts the dollar.
Yes, that's right.
Madam Chair, do you need a motion?
I do.
I move the, let's say it's the dash five, that Senate Bill, that we adopt the dash five amendment to 817, which establishes a 382,000 federal funds expenditure limitation for OEM for the project cost during 2005-2007.
Senator Winters moves adoption of the A5 amendments to Senate Bill 817, which establishes a $382,000 expenditure limitation. If there's no further discussion or objection, that motion is adopted. Senator Winters?
Madam Chair, I move the adoption of Senate Bill 817 A as amended to the full Senate Budget Committee.
Senator Winters, we need to back up and...
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the A4s were brought to me after I drafted my memo a few minutes before the meeting, so they are not incorporated in my memo. Oh. And the A4s put, basically in law, the State Interoperability Executive Council and its membership and another number of responsibilities around interoperability into the bill. I think both of the witnesses addressed that in their testimony.
So, Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the A4 amendments to Senate Bill 817.
Senator Winters moves the A4 amendments to Senate Bill 817, and if there's no further discussion or objection, that motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 817 as amended to the full Senate Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Winters has moved Senate Bill 817 A to the full Senate Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. And hearing no further discussion or objection, that motion is adopted. And Senator Winters, would you like to bring Bill forward?
I would be very honored.
Thank you. And Senator Metzger, we assume you're going to carry this on. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Murphy. Okay, we will now go back to a work session on Senate Bill 232. Do we have someone here who wishes to speak to Senate Bill 232? Is there anyone who... Okay. Ms. Mappy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senator Winters. Senate Bill 232 is sometimes referred to as the Juvenile Psychiatric Security Review Board or the Juvenile PSRB. It provides dispositional options for youth who have successfully asserted an insanity defense. What I've included in your packet is the flow chart that the proponents provided because I think it does a good job if there are questions about what exactly the bill does as we move through here. As you recall, we heard in public testimony on the 23rd that currently alleged delinquent youth have the constitutional right to assert the defense, but that the juvenile code is silent on the dispositional options. And Senate Bill 232 solves that problem by providing those dispositional options, as well as creating, it expands the current Psychiatric Security Review Board to include a 5-member juvenile panel. I have also in your packet dash 3 amendments for your approval. Basically, the dash 3 amendments push the bill off 2 years, and it eliminates the 0507 estimated fiscal impact. It obviously also removes the appropriation to the PSRB. In terms of the fiscal impact, I have drafted a fiscal impact, and again, it is part of your packet. It's based on the information that was provided by the agencies that are affected. As you can see from the front page, obviously there's no 507, but there is 0709. there will be a fiscal impact as a result of the bill. The difficulty was knowing how much, obviously, the fiscal impact, because there's no historical data on these youths. We don't know how many juveniles will be successful in asserting the defense, and then whether or not of those that are successful, whether they have a serious mental illness and or are a danger to themselves or others. Clearly, though, that once that happens and they come under the jurisdiction of the PSRB, then they will look to the Department of Human Services for services. The easiest part was determining the impact on the Psychiatric Security Review Board. As you can see there, it's basically the number of meetings. It's the per diem and travel costs are about $1,000 per meeting. The biggest impact and the one that we really don't know is the impact to the Department of Human Services. If you wanted to, Madam Chair, I could walk through the assumptions that generated those, and I've also included some 09-11 impact, and I know that sounds almost silly at this point because it's so far off, but if this caseload does materialize, there will be a roll-up cost. And so if you wanted to, we could briefly walk through that.
I would like to walk through the assumptions. I think it's important that we create as much of a record as possible about the intent. And, again, the assumptions will help us do that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to skip then to the DHS section, which is on page 2. Currently, DHS is estimating that approximately 20 juveniles, 10 having mental illness or disease, and 10 having developmental disabilities or mental retardation, will be successful at asserting the REI, which is responsibility except for insanity defense, and therefore require placement, supervision, and treatment services. The difference that you're going to see between this and when we heard this on the 23rd is that the caseload for the developmental disabilities program has increased. They've added some closed custody as we get to that section. The table there is a summary that shows you the breakout between the mental health programs, the developmental disability programs, and there's a small central administration charge that's almost, not even worth putting on there, but nonetheless it's part of it. I think it's also interesting to note, or important to note, that the department indicates that there's not current capacity in the existing systems to take on, which is essentially an on-demand services. This will create, in a sense, a mandated caseload for DHS. The mental health programs on page 3, I tried to provide a little bit of information about what that looks like. Again, 10 youths per year. They estimate that it'll stabilize to 40 to 50 youth in the fifth year. We'll probably have these young people for 3 to 4 years. Until then, they either are released or they transition into the adult system. And so you can see it will grow until we reach the new people stabilizing with the people who are being released out of the system. You can see the breakout there between program and our services and administration. The mental health side of the house has requested a position, half the FTE for the program admin. The service dollars appear to be, I believe, our continuum of services, where you start out with the most intensive to get stabilized, and then go through step down level of care. So I tried to show you the service rates, so you can see it's an expensive service delivery system, which isn't a surprise based on your experience with the DHS budget. I don't have for you or couldn't articulate what exactly the assumptions were in terms of the step down, for example, how long they would stay at secure inpatient and then go to residential treatment and those sorts of things. If you had questions about that, I'm hoping that perhaps somebody from the Department of Human Services could help with that. Again, you can see the estimated funding at a split. These services are eligible for Medicaid. That would be the other variable in addition to how long a juvenile would stay at a certain level of service, is whether or not it would be Medicaid eligible and for how long. And so the department's done the best they can to estimate. I think it was 10 to 11% would be eligible for Medicaid. And then, as you know, it's like a 40-60 split, general fund, federal funds. The Developmental Disabilities Program, again, is estimating 10 youths per year, split between the identified in a sense two programs, if you will, conditional release and then closed custody for those juveniles who would require the locked facility, which isn't something that they currently do, and that's why it presented a little bit of a challenge for them in the first place. I've showed you the split there between closed custody and conditional release, as well as, again, as I did with the mental health, what a roll-up might look like if, in fact, the caseload materialized. But, again, we don't know if it'll be 10 youth, 5, 15. That's the difficulty. Developmental disabilities in the estimated funding, closed custody would be 100% general fund. There wouldn't be any Medicaid available for that. And so that's the primary distinction there. The program would take one of their existing group homes and retrofit it so that it could be used for a secured facility. And, of course, there would be some ongoing maintenance associated with that as well.
Is this the existing group home that's in, Albany or?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, it wasn't identified in the fiscal which home it was.
Does someone out there know?
Mr. Tate?
You know where we're...
Thank you, Mr.
Madam Chair. James Tate from the Department of Human Services. No, we didn't identify a specific facility. We just thought we'd take a prototype and secure it. And I'm sure we'd probably have some zoning issues depending on how that would be coded under state and federal law. So, but we didn't identify it at this point.
You might want to stay there.
Okay.
And in looking ahead, did you also factor in if you have to retrofit or you have to make the facility more secure, are you planning to come back in 07 to talk about construction or remodeling, or was that included in some of these figures here, that assumption?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we included figures for initially retrofitting an existing facility, so that's included in here, the startup and the various security features that we would need to add. What that would look longer term, we really don't know at this point.
Just another looking ahead is... when we look at the closed custody versus looking at the community models, and I and an individual who is so community focused who we spent a lot of time of talking about this particular issue. And I noted that there's probably, where does corrections fit in all of this? After they become of age and we then transfer them to corrections, the board then is able to release them back into the community? Kind of give me some sense of direction with this particular piece. I'm just kind of growing.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, there's a lot of questions. We simply can't anticipate. For the developmental disability side, I can't speak for the mental health side. For the developmental disability side, for those kids that don't convert then to an adult psychiatric security review board status, I'm assuming we will carry them forward in our adult system. Once we have kids with disabilities in our custody, the chances of at some point turning them back on the street are very, very minimal. So in some capacity, we would have to carry them forward in our adult system. I think under the statute, there are certain conditions in which they can be transferred to the adult PSRB side, in which case then we would treat them, because we have a whole series of adults now that we have in conditional release programs, and the default for closed custody for adults now has been the forensic unit at Oregon State Hospital, which for DD folks is not necessarily the best fit to begin with. But on the adult side, it would be pretty much current practice. And if they weren't part of PSRB, like I said, I think presumably we would carry most of them forward as a mandated caseload into our adult system.
That answered my question.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Winters, the other agency impacted is the Oregon Youth Authority, and as you can see from the cover page, they estimated that, that perhaps there would be two youth that the responsibility for would transfer from their program to DHS, and that would be a one-time. And as you can see, the savings is pretty small, and given what I understand about the needs are in OYA, doubtful that. Well, that would be up to you whether or not we reduced the OAA budget to help offset the increases, if there are increases at DHS. I did note that the Public Defense Services Commission and the Oregon Judicial Department both indicated that the fiscal impact on, the, on their agencies would be minimal.
So, additional information?
I don't think so.
All right. I know you've been living and breathing this one for a while. Senator Winters, did you have additional?
Mr. Taves answered my question, because, as you know, I'm very concerned about the appropriateness of where individuals from our various systems and the kinds of services that they receive. And when he assured me, and I was needed that assurance, that when we were talking about the DD population, that they weren't going to be placed someplace that was inappropriate. So he's allayed any concerns that I may have. And I should have known that Mr. Tates would have known he's been in this field for so many years. That.
Thank you very much for your assistance.
Thanks.
I believe we are ready to move forward then. And we have a dash
three
on the left.
Madam Chair, I move the adoption of the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 232.
Senator Winters moves the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 232. Hearing no further discussion or objection, that motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 232 as amended to the... I've got to get my committee correct now. The Special Senate Budget Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Winters moves Senate Bill 232 as amended to the Senate Special Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation. And hearing no further discussion or objection, the motion is adopted. Senator Winters, would you like to hear any further business?
Yeah.
Any further business? Okay, all right, then we are adjourned.